swarm with a snake. Marigold could hear the vibrations from them. Helen stepped onto the porch. "Are you hungry again?" she asked. "I got some stew cooking. Got plenty of carrots in it. Carrots will give you strength."
"No, thanks. I'm still full from breakfast."
Helen had been practically force-feeding Marigold since she'd taken her in, and in that short time, Helen had managed to help Marigold gain some weight. Marigold's old dress was beginning to fit like it had before she lost her baby fat. Helen had introduced her to the other girls who lived at Kowicki's. They were all so much like each other that they were practically sisters. These women wore makeup and nice dresses, and they walked differently from the other girls, Marigold had known. But above all, they were kind to Marigold. They treated Marigold like she belonged to them. It was the first time since Marigold's family had expelled her from home that she felt the warmth of family. At night, the girls often sat beside Marigold, and they weren't afraid to touch her or embrace her or dote on her and call her pretty, and it had been a long time since anyone had touched Marigold or called her that.
"You sure you don't want any stew?" Helen asked. "How about I bring you just a little cup to sip on?" "No, thanks. I'm stuffed." "You need to keep eating, sweetie. You're just skin and bones."
There were five girls at Kowicki's altogether, and from the best Marigold could tell, they all seemed to understand the world around them better than Marigold did. Helen was older than the others. Her long, lean features and dark hair made her look like she'd walked out of a picture show. But Rachel was Marigold's favorite. She was blonde, with gaunt features and a sharp nose. In the weeks Marigold had been there, she noticed that all the male customers fawned over Rachel because she was the youngest. Earlier that morning, a red-headed young man had come to visit Rachel. He was more boy than man, closer to Rachel's age. Rachel behaved differently toward him than the girls behaved to the other men. She kissed him with her eyes closed, and she talked to him in a soft voice. Marigold asked Rachel about him, but Rachel refused to talk about it. There were some things women did not dare discuss for fear that they would not come true if they did. The weather was god-awful hot. The ground seemed to be softer than normal because of the heat. Marigold thought it felt like the whole world was melting, or maybe the whole world was dying. Marigold's red and white cotton dress had holes in the seams. She poked her fingers through one of the seams. She was falling apart, she thought, inside and out. She thought of Maggie every moment. She remembered the way the baby trusted her. That's what babies did. They trusted people. Maggie was the only creature who had ever trusted her. Marigold saw Maggie in her dreams every night, and in her dreams she saw Maggie's purple eyes and round face. A back door swung open, then slapped shut. The red-headed young man walked out of Rachel's room. He was shirtless and barefoot, with a wad of clothes beneath his arm. His cropped hair was the color of a new penny. He pulled suspenders over his white shoulders and stomped past Marigold. Rachel called to him, "Don't go, Lawrence! Please don't go!" But the young man was obviously upset. He clomped off the porch, then crawled into a car with chrome fenders. Rachel walked after him.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. I'm sorry."
Rachel walked barefoot on the gravel toward his car, gathering her skirt in her hands. "Please don't leave, not like this." But the redhead paid Rachel no mind. He fired his motor and sped away, leaving a puff of brown dust in the air behind his bumper. Rachel stood in the center of the road behind Kowicki's. She was too upset to even make tears. Or maybe women like Rachel had lost the ability to make tears. Maybe a girl can only make so many before she uses them all up. Marigold came behind Rachel and observed her porcelain face, sad but dry. Marigold said,
"Is everything okay?"
Rachel said nothing. Moments passed between them, and only the distant sound of the cicadas could be heard. Marigold rested her hand on Rachel's shoulder. She sensed a weight of sadness. The weight became so heavy, Marigold could not even remove her hand from beneath it. Rachel pulled away from her. She gave Marigold a bewildered look, but said nothing.
"It's hot," Rachel finally said. "Someone needs to hang another rattlesnake on the fence."
Then she walked to her room and left Marigold standing in the road. Helen was reclining on the porch railing, smoking a cigarette, watching the whole thing. Rachel brushed past her and buried her face in her hands. Marigold asked,
"What's it mean to hang a rattlesnake on the fence?"
Helen smiled.
"It's what old farmers used to do when they needed rain. They'd hang rattlesnakes on fences."
"Why?" asked Marigold.
"I don't know, sweetie. Folks always seem to be trying to make something happen that just won't."
Chapter 23. Wichita Dust. A black and brown cloud hung over the outskirts of Wichita, Kansas. It terrified Coot to even look at it. In the rear window of the speeding car, it looked like it was only a few miles behind them and getting closer. These dusty clouds didn't swirl like the cyclones did, and they didn't have flat bottoms like rain clouds. These were dark, evil clouds that were black. Only a few days before, a cloud had settled on Kansas that turned the world into midnight. It had poisoned the air so that breathing could give a man dust pneumonia. All the kids Coot knew had suffered from it at one time or another. Coot had dust pneumonia twice before. Once it got so bad he couldn't get out of bed for 3 weeks and had to breathe through a wet rag. The dust in the rear window stretched for miles and had covered the sun, making it look like a reddish ball dimming the light above Wichita. It made the town look like something from the Book of Revelation. Wind kicked up against the Hudson, knocking the car from side to side. The sounds of sand and dust whizzed against the window and covered the highway. Blake gripped the wheel and made the car go faster. "I can't see the road," he said.
"You think we can outrun it?"
Blake didn't answer. They drove on a bumpy highway through the outskirts of Wichita and into the town. Dozens of cars were pulled onto the sides of the roads, abandoned, already half covered in the sand. Coot saw people running into barns, sheds, and homes with boarded windows. The cloud moved closer. The wind took the roof off a tin building in the distance. Coot saw the roof spin the air and land in a hayfield, then tumble end over end.
"We're not going to make it," hollered Coot.
Blake hit the gas. The dust was getting close. Coot couldn't see the horizon anymore. He only saw blackness. It seemed as though the buildings and houses and highways had been swallowed by the devil. Blake swerved into a filling station and slammed the car into park. The car jumped the curb and rocked into the violent wind. They leapt out of the vehicle and jogged toward the front door. The wind gust knocked Coot from his feet. His shoes slid on the sand beneath him and he fell face forward. Dust and grit stung his cheeks and eyes. He covered his face. Blake lifted him and shoved him through the door of the service station. Inside were people, lots of them, seated on the floor in clumps. They were listening to a radio on the counter. It was the unmistakable sound of preaching. Coot could hear the familiar cadence of words, a sing-song-like delivery. He was drawn to the sound. He found a place near the radio so he could hear it better. Through the static and crackles, he heard the voice, breaking through the dust. The people welcomed Coot and Blake inside and gave them wet rags to hold over their faces. A boy who was Coot's age held a polka-dot rag over his nose and mouth. He coughed now and then.
"This is a bad one,"
said the boy. Coot pressed the cloth over his face. His cheeks stung from the sand and his eyes were dry and scratched with debris. The voice on the radio was delivering words in a way Coot had never heard before. The man wasn't just yelling. He was firing his words like a sharp shooting rifle. He never paused to think of what he'd say next. He never broke the rhythm of his words. His sentences flowed from his mouth like a steady current that could not be stopped. And the people in the room hallelujah'd and yes lorded in quiet voices.
"Amen, J. Wilbur," said one man.
"Say it, brother."
"Amen,"
said a woman's muffled voice behind a rag. The voice on the radio belonged to J. Wilbur Chaplin. The words, the delivery, the fury made Coot forget all about the storm and feel nothing but wonder. He was mesmerized by the evangelist. He hadn't expected this. It was like nothing he'd ever heard. And when he looked at the people's faces, he could tell they were listening just as closely as he was. And when the preaching ended, an organ played, and a few people hummed along. "Lose all their guilty stains, lose all their guilty stains," sang one woman. "They keep getting worse," said one old man, clicking off the radio. "You heard what the preacher said. It's the judgment."
"Worst storm this year," said another. "Ain't had no rain since October."
"God's wrath," said another old man.
"Wrath poured out without mixture upon the wicked," said another.
"All that's missing is the brimstone," said Blake.
Chapter 24. Summer Showers. The two vehicles crept forward on a dirt highway in the middle of the night. The stars were so bright they cut through the thin clouds. Pete looked out the car window at the stars and felt lost in them while Vern drove the Model T coupe behind Paul's truck. In the car were Pete, his sister, Reese, Vern, and a bloodhound named Louisville, who sat between Pete and Vern, snoring and making smells that even hardened war criminals couldn't endure without begging for mercy. Pete petted the dog while he stared at the night sky. Vern had the dashboard radio playing. The preachman on the radio hollered. Vern paid close attention while he drove. Pete asked, "Why do you like this preacher so much?"
"Jay Wilbur? Just do, I guess. I like to hear him get all riled up. He can sure get mad at the devil."
Pete continued to pet Louisville. The fur beneath her eyes was soft as silk. She had white around her snout beneath her eyes.
"Is Louise an old dog?"
"Yeah, she's an old woman."
For most of the ride, Pete had met his equal with Vern. The two talked so little that they didn't make enough words to fill up a teacup. Pete was miles above the car, caught in the blue night and the stars. Ahead of them, he could see the silhouette of his mother in the truck cab. The highway seemed to go on for hours. They hadn't passed a single car all night. None of the rural houses had lights on. It was cool outside, and Pete thanked the stars for that. The unforgiving heat of the day, coupled with the drought, made the world feel merciless.
"You been on the road with your mama a long time?" Vern asked.
"Yeah, long time."
"Us too."
More silence.
Where you sleep?" asked Vern.
"Oh, anywhere. Most times I sleep in the car."
"Us too."
Silence again.
"Do it make you tired, all this traveling around?"
"Yeah, my mom's tired. I can tell. She's tired all the time."
"Us too."
Pete let out a sigh and leaned back into his seat. He let his hand rest on the dog.
You ever get scared?"
"Yeah."
"Is you scared now?"
Pete had to think about that a moment.
"Little."
"Me too. But you know what Jay Wilbur say? He say, 'Blessed are the meek who shall inherit the whole earth.'"
"Meek? What's that mean?"
"Don't know, but I pray God make me good and meek, like, so maybe I can get all that sort of land to call my own one day."
"Me too."
Silence passed between them.
"Where are we going?" Pete asked.
"Butler County," Paul said.
"What's in Butler County?"
"Work."
"What kind?"
Vern shrugged.
"Don't really know. I just go where Paul tells me to go."
Pete cranked the window down before he became dizzy from all the fumes. Vern grinned at Pete. It was the first time the big man's friendly eyes had really inspected Pete.
"That's a real nice hat you wear."
Pete removed a big hat and observed it. It was buckskin, with a leather strip of rawhide tied around the crown. The hat band had been stuffed with newspaper so that it would fit his boyish head.
"It was my daddy's."
"Where your daddy?"
Pete looked in the night sky.
"Way up there somewhere."
Vern looked at the stars through the windshield.
"Mine too."
Chapter 25, Judgment Days. Paul glanced into the rearview mirror. Vern and Pete were close behind. He checked his speedometer, careful to keep the needle 3 ticks above the number 20. 23 was his lucky number when it came to gas mileage. Whenever the truck went too far over that speed, the old thing started burning oil and making strange noises that sounded like someone was hiding beneath the hood with a short-barrel shotgun. Paul reached for a cigarette and found that the pack in his shirt pocket was empty. He almost swore, but the woman was in the passenger seat next to him. He tossed the carton out the window and looked at Baby Ruth, bouncing in the woman's arms. He forced a smile. Baby Ruth wasn't crying anymore, but she wasn't calm either. She was fidgety, but lethargic, much like he was feeling.
"You know," said the woman, "I realized I don't even know your full name."
But Paul didn't answer. He wasn't trying to be rude. He simply was too busy patting his pockets for a cigarette. He was certain he had one lying around here somewhere. He looked on the dashboard and between the seats. He searched the floorboards and found nothing. He finally gave up searching. He pulled in a breath of air and mumbled an ugly word through gritted teeth in a whisper.
"Where'd you find this little girl?"
"Who, Baby Ruth?"
"You know, you don't have to call her that. Pete just gets excited about things sometimes. He daydreams and comes up with these ridiculous ideas."
Paul smiled. It's a good name. Ruth. My grandmother's name was Ruth.
Really?
No, I just made that up. Her name was Josephine, and she was the devil. Paul dug into his shirt pocket and showed her the folded newspaper clipping. Eula scanned it and said, "Good heavens! A mother leaves her baby, and in these hard times, this world is in big trouble, ain't it?"
"Worst trouble I ever seen.
People don't act civil no more."
"No, they don't, and they don't trust nobody no more."
"You reckon these is the judgment days?"
Paul shrugged. "Maybe.
Lots of people claim these were the judgment days. It wasn't just the droughts and the absence of jobs that made them say that. It was the boll weevil eating through all the cotton. It was the food shortages in Atlanta, the scarlet fever and tuberculosis, the dust in Kansas and Oklahoma, the bread lines in New York and New Jersey, and the price of living. It was enough tragedy that it made weaker-minded men kill themselves, and suicide was becoming an epidemic in some places."
"You reckon God's going to wipe us all off the planet?"
"I don't know, but it don't make no difference either way to me. God does his thing, and I do mine. I don't bother him, and I ask him to give me the same treatment." A long silence passed between them. Eula rocked the baby in her arms until the child fell asleep. And so did Eula. Her eyes were shut tight. She coughed now and then. It was a productive cough that sounded like her lungs were rattling. Paul watched her and felt sorry for her and for all she'd been through. He felt sorry for her children and for the baby, and even sorry for himself, for he was out of cigarettes. Then the sky was lit with red and purple light for only a moment. Paul could hardly believe it. The sound of thunder shook the highway. It happened again, and for a flash, the tree line became visible before an electric sky. "Well, I'll be," said Paul in a whisper. He didn't want to say it too loud. He didn't want to wake the tired woman beside him. Paul pulled the car over. Vern pulled over behind him, crackling on the gravel shoulder. Paul stepped out of the truck, removed his hat, and looked upward. The sky was putting on a light show for the world to see. It hadn't rained since 3 weeks before they started construction on the Dreyfus barn. In fact, their dry world had gone so long without rain, Paul couldn't even remember what the stuff smelled like, and the smell of rain was his favorite smell. It awakened the farmer inside him, which was a piece of himself he thought had been eaten up by the boll weevils and the greedy banks. "You think she's going to go?" said Vern, walking toward him, looking upward. "Don't know," said Paul.
They waited several minutes until it finally started, one drop at a time. The rain began beating the roofs of the two vehicles, slow at first, then harder. Soon it sounded like a freight train crashing into the world, loud, heavy, warm water. Paul laughed with an open mouth. He let the hot rain hit his old face and felt the weight of the heavy drops on his cheeks.
"Reckon someone must have hung a rattlesnake on a fence," said Vern.
Paul squatted onto the ground and bowed his head. He let the rainwater run all over his greasy hair and down his back. He felt his shirt, saturated, stick to his back.
"God," he said in a soft voice only meant for the heavens, "if you're up there, please, I beg of you, dear Lord, please let me find a cigarette."
Chapter 26. Lightning Strikes.
"Get up,"
were the only words Marigold heard. And when Marigold opened her eyes, she was looking at Helen, who was lying beside her.
"What is it?"
asked Marigold. "Lightning. Thunder. Rumbling."
"That," said Helen. "Hear it?"
The surface of the walls inside the room became white and blue for an instant. Then the light disappeared and the place went black. Then blue again, and black.
"I think it's going to rain," said Helen.
Helen jumped out of bed and walked toward the window. She was obviously excited.
"Come on, it's a storm."
A low rumble vibrated the cabin and rail car. Then a loud clap of thunder that made Helen smile. Then another clap. The world lit up flickering white. Helen counted.
1 Chattahoochee, 2 Chattahoochee, 3.
The whole earth shook like it would fall apart. Another lightning flash. Helen counted again.
1 Chattahoochee.
Rumbles shook the place.
"It's getting closer," said Helen.
Outside on Kawiki's front porch, Rachel was already standing with the other girls, watching the sky. They were quiet, wearing nightgowns, smoking cigarettes, arms crossed. It was an eerie atmosphere. The dark world was calm between episodes of thunder and flashes of light. Laughing Girl stood beside Rachel. She was a tall, slender woman with long black hair and cocoa skin. She told Marigold she was Cherokee, and she must have been. Her cheekbones were so high they made her eyes look pinched. Rachel said, "Don't hear no rain. Could be it's on the heat lightning."
"No, it is coming," said Laughing Girl.
"How do you know?" Marigold asked.
"My hair," Laughing Girl replied. "My hair knows when it will rain."
"Well, that's ridiculous," said Helen. Marigold could not remember the last time it had rained. Months, lots of months, too many months. Helen stepped off the porch and looked at the sky.
"Come on, Lord, do it up big tonight."
They all watched the sky. Nobody said anything. They only waited. The first few drops hit the tin roof on the porch and made a marvelous sound.
"There it is," said Helen. "Don't just stand there. Come on."
Helen led Marigold and the others across the dusty road, through the pines, to the peanut field down the road from the Kawiki's rail car. A single oak sat in the field surrounded by a tin shed, dead peanut plants, and a few cattle. The girls walked through the field in the empty darkness, stepping between the rows of dead foliage toward the tin building. It was a leaning structure with a rusted roof. Helen unlatched the door and muscled it open. Inside were wooden barrels with rusty rings and dry-rotted tops. Helen rolled one outside, spinning it on its rim. She popped the top and positioned the barrel beneath the gutter spout of the shed.
"Well, don't stand there," said Helen. "Help me. These things ain't exactly light."
"What are we doing?" asked Marigold. But Helen wasn't listening to her. She was already rolling another barrel with Laughing Girl. They placed it beneath the eave of the tin roof. When three barrels were positioned around the shed, the sky opened itself. The smacking raindrops got louder and sounded like a mighty waterfall. The shower cooled Marigold's red hair, and it made her wonder about Maggie. She wondered where she was and if she was safe. She hoped Maggie could see the rain. The rain fell harder. It pelted the tin roof and made noises so loud it sounded like a train. Water ran across the tin roof and trickled into the barrels. Helen said,
4 months and 6 days. That's almost half a year without water. 4 months and 6 long days.
The girls stood inside the shed watching a downpour saturate the field around them. But not Helen. She was out in it, letting it mat her hair against her head and her clothes to her body. To Marigold, the rain was the smell she liked best. It smelled and tasted like some kind of miracle, and it sounded even better. Rachel broke the silence by saying to Marigold,
"Lawrence said he's going to take me away with him when he leaves for Birmingham."
Marigold only looked at her with a warm smile. Water dripped from Rachel's brow from her strands of light hair. Rachel went on,
"He said he's going to buy me a house and we're going to settle down and, you know, make a family."
Marigold touched Rachel on the shoulder. She felt a tingling beneath her hand. It ran up her arm, through her head, and then down her legs. It was such a strong sensation of loneliness that it almost made her stomach turn upside down. The tingling became stronger and stronger. She released Rachel's shoulder and steadied her breathing. But to Marigold's surprise, Rachel didn't seem to notice anything out of the ordinary. She was smiling and watching the rain.
"He said he loved me,"
Rachel added.
"He loves me."
Laughing Girl said,
"Love. May lightning strike him dead if he is lying to you."
The sky flashed again. Chapter 27. Motor Ends. All Wichita was covered in a film of dust and sand. Cars were stripped of their paint. Street lamps were broken. The Hudson had piles of grit on the hood and on the roof. Once, the vehicle had been a plain black. Now, it was bare metal in many places. They left the wind-swept city and drove through the dry landscape. They passed mounds of red and tan dust piled on the sides of the dust-covered highway like miniature mountains. At least, they thought this was the highway. There was no way to be sure since they could see nothing but dust before them, behind them, and around them. Blake pulled into a motor inn just outside the sandy city of Eureka. The wind was still blowing dust along the streets, making swirls and tiny cyclones. It was hard to see where the sidewalk stopped and the curbs began. The Motor Inn was a low building with a flat roof, boarded windows, and a dirt-covered parking lot filled with dilapidated cars that were almost all paint-stripped and dented. Blake went inside and returned to the Hudson with a key ring. "We're living high cotton tonight," Blake said. The room was nice. It had a bathtub with a shower and a frilly curtain around a claw-foot tub. There were two single beds and a big wooden radio sat on the dresser.
"Look at the size of that radio," said Coot.
Blake whistled. Coot turned on the radio and the sounds of horns and banjos filled the little room.
"They got jazz here," Coot said, turning up the radio.
"Sounds like it."
"They have jazz in Alabama?"
"Have it. Why, we invented it." Blake lit a cigar and tapped the ember against an ashtray. He tipped his boot upside down and a stream of sand fell out of it. Coot listened to the music with great curiosity and happiness, for it was curious and happy music. A vocalist sang cheery melodies, wiggling her voice in a way that revival singers did not.
"How much longer until Alabama?" said Coot.
"Never you mind. You just listen to the Dixie music. We'll be there soon enough." Blake sat straight in his bed and knocked the heels of his boots together. "Mobile makes this place look like a burn pile."
"It does?"
"Oh, yeah. Alabama's like Eden, only without all the snakes." Coot flipped past the stations on the radio until he landed on one that played the sound of a baseball game. The cheering crowd did something to him, made him feel excited, a feeling he did not have often, but his excitement began to sire in him when he remembered the men in the police car chasing them.
"What if they catch us, Blake?"
Blake didn't speak. He only blew a cloudy breath at the ceiling and watched it gather around the ceiling fan. Then he leaned forward and turned off the radio. His face went from lighthearted to serious. He touched his mustache and took in a few labored breaths like he was thinking. Blake reached into a brown leather bag and retrieved the metal box he'd stolen from EP. It was a red tin box with a wire handle on it. He placed it in Coot's lap and said, "This money belongs to you, Coot. You and your mama. And if anything happens to me..."
"Blake, don't talk like that."
"No, I mean it. There's a lot in there, and it ain't mine."
"Blake."
"There's enough in that box to put me away for a long time. And if anything happens to me, you go find a bus station and go as far away as you can. Doesn't matter where." Coot didn't like hearing him talk like this. It filled him with fear and made his lungs cold.
"Blake, I couldn't make it on my own."
"Now you listen to me." Blake replaced the money box in the bag and zipped it shut. He plopped the entire bag in Coot's lap. "Don't never let that money out of sight."
"But..."
"Hush, and let me finish. Now, you're a lot more courageous than you think you are, and I want you to remember that." He patted Coot's hair. "If I was you, I'd quit thinking about all these bad things and get cleaned up."
"Get cleaned up for what?"
"I'd put on my nice duds, too. Wouldn't want to be late, you know."
"Late for what?"
Blake leaned back on the bed, resting his head on the pillow. He let out a chest full of blue smoke and coughed. The coughing lasted a few minutes. The dust had done a number on them both.
"Where are we going, Blake?"
"I'd grease up my shoes real good and fix my hair." Blake coughed again.
"Why, Blake, where are we going?"
"Of course, that's just how I do it. I mean, you can do what you want. You're practically a grown man anyway. Besides, what a fellow wears to his first baseball game ain't nobody's business but his own."
"Baseball? Are you putting me on?"
Blake coughed again. "Why, Coot, I'm offended. Would old Blake lie to you?" Chapter 28. Stealing Home. The baseball bat made a cracking sound that could probably be heard all the way to China. Coot had only heard this particular noise a few times in his life. He'd heard a bat hit a ball before, certainly, but never with this kind of sincerity. The sound did something to him. So did the smacking sound the ball made when it hit the catcher's mitt. They sat in the nosebleeds high above the small diamond. Coot watched the men on the field run from bag to bag. These men didn't just trot like farmers in the rural leagues. These men were running full speed, earning their paychecks when they slid into home plate, and Coot could even hear their voices. The players would scream at each other. The umpire would shout back at them. Cuss words were abundant. Coot found himself shouting at the top of his lungs, too, during important plays. When the Joplin Miners took the lead against the Wichita Aviators, he became so excited he forgot all about his peanuts in the red and white bag, and when the game ended, Coot was sorry it was over. Afterward, Blake and Coot walked through the corridors of the small ballpark, making their way to the exit. Blake said, "You know, I used to play a little ball, too."
"You did?"
"Little. It wasn't bad. Had me a chance to play with the Pine Bluff Judges out of Arkansas, but I didn't do it."
"Why not?"
Blake sighed. "A woman, Coot." "You mean you were in love with a girl?"
"No, Coot. A woman. That's different from a girl. A woman makes you do things you never thought you'd do. I was in love up to my eyeballs with her."
"What'd she make you do?"
"She made me as stupid as room temperature mud is what she done. There I was in a traveling show, and she was a high society lady. The two don't match up no matter how you spin it."
"Is that where you learned to twirl a rope in the traveling show?"
"Where I learned a lot of worthless things."
"Well, what happened with her?"
"Well, she hurt me, that's what happened. I thought I'd never get over her. Last I heard, she married a banker in Greensburg. Broke my heart. You never get over someone choosing a banker instead of you."
When they neared the door, Blake stopped walking. Coot could feel Blake's body tense. He gripped Coot's shoulder and held him back. It all happened so fast that it took a moment for Coot to even realize that something was wrong. His mind was too much on double plays, home runs, and infield flies. But Blake's eyes were fixed on the men in the distance, men with badges. Coot could see them. Four men in khaki uniforms lingering by the exit sign. One man wore a leather jacket with a hat tilted sideways on his head. Blake coughed a few times into his fist. He closed his eyes. He stroked his thick mustache. Coot said, "Are those cops?"
"They sure ain't the welcome committee, I can tell you that much."
"What do we do?"
"You hush and follow me is what you do."
They wandered through the ballpark, weaving through rows of seats, up the aisles, pausing every few moments to look behind them. Coot carried a bulky leather bag with both hands. Blake moved fast, and Coot moved quick behind him. Soon they were on the field, jogging across the cropped grass toward a tall outfield wall. A large advertisement for B&R headache powder was over the left field. Blake found a door within the giant ampersand on the wall. The door led into the dirt parking lot with a few tractors and chalk spreaders and baskets of baseballs. They crept toward their Hudson, pausing to take cover behind the vehicles. Blake told Coot to get on all fours and peek beneath the cars to see if the coast was clear. When they neared the area where they left the Hudson, they could see the vehicle surrounded by more men in official-looking uniforms. The door of the vehicle, though it had been battered by dust, revealed the faintest remnants of text on the side advertising the gospel troupe. Blake swore.
"What now?" asked Coot.
"I'm thinking, Coot." They backtracked through the stadium and found the nosebleed seats again. Then they crouched low. They stayed there for a few hours until the park emptied and the sun went down. Neither of them spoke a word. Finally, Coot fell asleep, using the brown leather bag for a pillow. When the sky was black, they climbed the fence on the east edge of the park. They walked back toward the motel through the darkness until Coot had developed blisters on his feet. When they reached the Motor Inn parking lot, Blake stopped walking and squatted beneath the delivery truck tire. He swore again.
"What is it?"
Coot said. But no sooner had he said it than he saw what Blake was cussing at. It was a man in the distance wearing a badge, standing beside their motel door. "Those rabbit-chasing grunts ain't got nothing better to do than go after an old man.
Are we done for?"
But Blake was in no mood to answer. He remained quiet, letting his mind work overtime. After several moments, Blake finally flashed a flimsy smile and said, "No, we ain't licked yet." And Coot knew that even though Blake had promised he never would, he was lying. Chapter 29, The Long Green.
"No thanks, I got all the tobacco pickers I can stand," said Mr. Harrison. "If it's work you're looking for, I'll go ask my competitor for a job. They'll probably pay worse than I do, though."
"I know you got plenty of pickers," said Paul, "but you ain't got five pickers for the price of two."
Mr. Harrison leaned against the dry barn and removed his hat.
He used a handkerchief to dab his black hair. He was a short man, broad-shouldered and stout. He let out a colossal sigh and studied Pete, Fern, Eulah, Reese, and Baby Ruth with hard eyes.
"Can them two young'uns work?"
Mr. Harrison asked. Paul scoffed. "Why, those two young'uns could pull their own weight better than any two young'uns you ever saw."
"And how about the bull?"
said Mr. Harrison, nodding toward Vern.
"He's got a name," said Paul.
Mr. Harrison let out a demeaning chuckle. Then Harrison looked into the distance at the long green fields of tobacco leaves. Harrison's workers labored in the sunlight, wearing straw hats and canvas sacks slung around their shoulders. They picked weeds from behind the wide, leafy rows, placing the field daisies and the jimson weed into bags a handful at a time. Harrison whistled at two workers who were close by. Two men came running. They were wiry, with long necks and leathery skin. They stood before Mr. Harrison with bent backs and humble faces. Mr. Harrison rubbed his chin, staring at him. He seemed to be thinking. Finally, he announced,
"One of you's fired."
His words didn't resonate right away. It took a few moments before they settled on the men. The faces of the young men became long and serious. They looked at Harrison, waiting for more words, but there were none. Mr. Harrison was only wearing a strange smirk. One man answered,
Boss, you firing us?"
"No, just one of you."
The men wore confused faces.
"Which one of us?" said the other man.
Mr. Harrison crossed his arms.
"Whichever one of you beats the other."
The men looked at each other in what was obviously disbelief. They removed their hats and let out nervous laughs.
But boss, Clarence is my friend. We've been friends since we was kids."
"Don't make me repeat myself, you two,"
said Mr. Harrison.
"I got a man to fire, and one of you better get to kicking the other one's tail, or you'll both be out of a job."
The men grew uncomfortable on their feet. One man threw down his weed sack and his hat. But Paul had already had enough. He grabbed the hands of Pete and Eulah and said, "We don't need jobs that bad. Good day to you, sir."
"No, no,"
shouted Mr. Harrison, keeping his attention on the two fieldmen.
"Now I just give you boys an order."
His voice was low and threatening.
"You gonna sit there and defy me, or you gonna listen to your boss, man?"
The men pleaded. They begged. Mr. Harrison swore in a voice that rang throughout the country, then removed his hat. He shot forward and threw his heel into the back of one man's knee. The man fell face first onto the dirt.
"I give you an order, son,"
shouted Mr. Harrison through clenched teeth.
"An order, you hear me?"
The other man rushed toward Mr. Harrison and tackled him. The three men rolled in the dust together until Mr. Harrison was on top one of the other men. But before he could take a swing, Vern handed Baby Ruth to Paul and strode toward the men with a calm gait. Vern picked up Harrison with both hands. He lifted the man's body high above his head. Onlookers who had started to gather wore big eyes at the giant who held Mr. Harrison in the air. Vern walked slowly toward the barn, holding Harrison with massive arms. Paul had never seen such a display of strength. Vern sat the man on the ground. He straightened the man's collar. Then he glared at Harrison and said,
"Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth."
Paul and Vern took the children and Eulah and left. Chapter 30. Heartbreak. It was a magnificent Saturday. The crickets were making such a loud noise it seemed as though they were singing. The tavern at Kowicki's was empty, and so were the rooms. The girls reclined on the porch, listening to the tranquilizing sounds of the piney forest. Then came the sound of tires on gravel. A chrome-fendered car rushed into the drive, and the doors flew open. A woman, a sophisticated woman with pearls on and matching earrings, jumped out. Her hair was done. Her shoes matched her green dress. The woman walked onto Kowicki's back porch, uninvited and unannounced. Her shoes made loud noises on the floorboards like a log drum. And she had children with her. One child was balanced on her hip. The other, a toddler, standing beside her, holding the woman's hand. The woman looked out of place on a porch like this. The girls, barefoot, wearing silk robes, became uncomfortable. Helen approached the woman first. The woman, however, did not move or give Helen a smile. She only cut Helen off before she could ask anything.
"I'm looking for Rachel," the woman said.
The girls stiffened. They stabbed cigarettes into coffee tins filled with sand and looked at each other. One by one, they stood and wandered into their rooms.
Okay, said Helen. "Just calm down. What's this about?"
The woman's face was not getting calmer, but red. She adjusted the child on her hip and said, I am calm. I want to see Rachel, please. Helen didn't move her body. She only nodded toward Marigold. Go inside and get Rachel. In a few minutes, Rachel stood on the porch before the woman in green. Marigold noted how the two couldn't have looked more different. Rachel looked younger than the woman and less sophisticated. The woman set her child on the porch. She smoothed her dress and stepped toward Rachel with slow steps. She placed inches between their noses and made her eyes small. The woman said, So, you're the one. Marigold could see the faces of the others looking through the window panes.
It's you. You're the one Lawrence keeps coming to see.
Rachel looked embarrassed. The woman took another stride forward. Then she reared back and slapped Rachel. The loud sound made Marigold cringe. But Rachel only looked at the woman. Silence passed between them. Then Rachel touched her own face and started to cry. The woman pointed to the children who stood behind her.
You see those children? They belong to Lawrence and me, and I want you to have a good look at them.
The children stood motionless, wide-eyed.
Look at them. Do you see them?
Rachel nodded. The woman said,
Now you listen to me. You're nothing to him, nothing. And that ain't even the saddest part. The sad part is Lawrence don't even have the guts to tell you what a nothing you are to him, and he sent me to do it for him.
The woman held her gaze almost as if she were daring Rachel to do something. Finally, she lifted a child under her hip and gripped the other by the hand, and then she was gone. Marigold stepped toward her. She let Rachel collapse into her arms. Rachel began to sob with groans that were too deep for words. Marigold felt the heat build in her palms, like it had before when she laid her hand on the hairy man in the bar. This time, her hand was so hot it stung. It frightened Marigold. But with an unexplained urge, she touched Rachel's face. When she did, she felt a sharp pain in her chest just below her breastbone. The sensation was so piercing, it made her moan. Rachel touched Marigold's hand and pressed it harder into her own cheek. Rachel said, Oh, Marigold, I feel like my heart's bleeding inside me.
I know, said Marigold. I feel it too.
And the crickets sang all night long.
Chapter 31. Best Friends. The morning light spread across the uneven cobblestones. Coots stood before a bus, holding a brown leather bag containing the money box, a few sets of clothes, and a collection of trinkets he held dear. The bus engine before him spit gray exhaust into the morning air. There were men in suits carrying duffel bags and women in skirts with handbags. They all boarded the bus in a horde. They seemed busy, hurried, and they behaved like their lives were more important than they truly were. The sign on the front of the large silver vehicle read Birmingham, Alabama. Coot waited on the sidewalk, observing his own reflection in a shop window. Behind his reflection were mannequin torsos wearing suits. In reflection, he looked awkward. His long, skinny neck, his puny shoulders. He thought himself to be an ugly kid. Maybe the ugliest who ever lived. Blake was several yards away, speaking to the bus driver. Their voices were drowned out by the sound of the heavy engine. But Coot could see the driver nodding and listening to whatever Blake was saying. Coot looked at his own reflection again. Why couldn't God have made his ears a little bit smaller? Or at least God could have made his neck shorter. We're all set, said Blake, appearing in the shop window reflection behind Coot. Nice looking men, ain't we? Coot shrugged. Blake tussled Coot's hair. You go into your paws, just give it time. Then Blake squatted on his heels before Coot and fixed his collar. Gosh, Coot, I'm sorry I couldn't get your baseball bat. Too many cops around the car.
It's okay.
Blake shook his head. No, it ain't okay. That was your bat. Coot was indeed sorry he didn't have the bat. It was the most impressive thing he'd ever owned. But the truth was, he'd forgotten about it ever since they'd been running from dust and hiding from deputies in dark corners of a foreign city. Blake placed his hand on Coot's head. The hand weighed more than Coot thought. One day, you're going to forget all about me, you know that?
No, I won't.
Oh, yes, you will. And you should forget. You know, I ain't brought you nothing but trouble. I should have taken you away from me, Pete, a long time ago. I hold myself personally responsible for all you went through. Stop it, Blake.
I'm bad luck, buddy. Blake cleared his throat and flashed a big smile. But hey, we're going to start a new life, you and me, right? We'll have big fun together. This bus is going to take us straight to the promised land, and maybe, once you finally see Alabama, you'll forgive me.
Blake, you ain't done nothing wrong.
Blake brought himself eye level with Coot and looked both ways. Coot noticed the old man's eyes were pink and wet. Blake said in a whisper, I'm putting you in charge of our money. Hear me? And Coot nodded. Blake made his voice soft. Now the first rule of carrying money is always be touching your money. Always. Understand?
Why do you want me to carry it?
Repeat the first rule back to me, Coot.
Always be touching your money.
Blake cupped his ear. How often should you be touching it?
Always.
Blake grinned. Second rule is don't let nobody else touch it. Never. Especially not a friend. A lot of friends in this life will do you wrong, Coot. It's just human nature. They don't mean nothing by it. People is just people, and people can be cruel. And Blake smacked Coot's shoulders. He gave Coot a big look with a weight of pride behind it. I love you, Coot, and you deserve that blamed bite. I'm only sorry I couldn't get it for you.
Blake, shouldn't you be the one to carry the money? I don't think I'm...
You're a brave kid, brother. Bravest I ever knowed. Something was very wrong. Coot could feel it in the air. The bus driver stepped off the bus and hollered. People fit in last goodbyes. Men kissed women. Children hugged mothers. People hurried onto the bus. The driver exchanged a look with Blake. Blake only nodded at the man. Come on, said Blake. We got a bus to catch. When they reached the door, Blake stopped walking. He tussled Coot's hair and said, Coot, you go ahead and get us a good seat. I gotta use the John. The engine fired. The bus brakes creaked.
Hurry, Blake.
Blake winked at Coot. I'm right behind you. Coot boarded the bus. He walked the narrow aisle toward a seat in the rear. He placed the brown bag beside himself. An old man walked by and tried to sit next to Coot, but Coot waved him off. The old man mumbled something when he walked away. Another passenger tried to sit beside Coot, a woman with a toddler.
Sorry, the seat's taken, said Coot.
The woman said,
You can't reserve seats on a bus, kid. It ain't the way it works. My friend's in the bathroom, said Coot.
The woman stormed off and took her toddler to the back of the bus. After a few moments, the bus driver threw the vehicle into gear.
Wait, wait, my friend's still in the bathroom, Coot shouted.
Coot could see the driver's face in the large rearview mirror. The bus driver's eyes were solemn.
I'm really sorry, kid. Really sorry, said the bus driver.
He pulled the door shut and gunned the engine. Coot shot forward, toting the leather bag in both hands, stomping down the center aisle. He fumbled past the passengers, knocking the bag against them on his way to the front.
Stop! Stop! My friend's still out there!
But the mammoth vehicle was already rolling forward. Coot froze in his tracks and realized what was happening. He looked out the narrow glass doors. He could see Blake standing on the pavement in the rear window.
Please, please, shouted Coot. Look, he's right there. Back up and let him on the bus.
The bus did not stop. Blake's figure was getting smaller in the distance. The tall, wiry man with the mustache stood on the curb. Coot said through tears,
Blake! Don't do this.
Coot could feel the bus engine beneath his feet. The driver changed gears and picked up speed. Soon they were on the highway. Blake's figure was a pinpoint on the far-off landscape. The driver gave Coot a look.
He told me it was for your own good, son, he said. But he told me to give you this.
The bus driver removed something from behind his own seat. A hickory baseball bat. Brand new, wrapped in ribbon. Book 2, Chapter 32, Babies and to Girls. Paul watched the sun rise over the tobacco field. Whenever sun spread itself on the leaves, it looked like the backyard of heaven, dotted with the first colors of a coming autumn. The fading green color of the world was overwhelming. The scent, clean smelling. The aroma of wet dirt and earth was strong enough to taste. The sound of a radio nearby cut through the rural morning. It was blasting an official voice into the air. One that talked about a war and the invasion of Pearl Harbor. The voices on the radio had changed since the war began. Men talked a little louder and more staccato. They had anxiety in their words and fear. Paul's family had worked on 4 tobacco farms in 3 years before they finally found work with Mr. Pettigrew. And in those years of uncertainty, Paul had never found a man who was as kind as Mr. Pettigrew. Most men in tobacco farming were bitter, looking for fast money, and treated their mostly black field workers with cruelty. The hateful things Paul had heard and seen done had changed the way he viewed the human race. But Mr. Pettigrew was not like this. He hired Paul, Vern, Eula, and Pete, and he paid them the wages of 3 workers. Even though they did the work of 8 workers, it was steady money. Pettigrew treated them like his own family. During holidays, he invited workers to his own home to celebrate. He gave gifts to the children of the field workers. He served mountains of food. Long tables were filled with casseroles, pies, and dishes of all kinds, and his men worked hard for Mr. Pettigrew because of it. In the early sun, Paul watched the morning's first workers move through the crops before the midday heat got too strong. Paul had not cared for tobacco work when he first arrived. His work wasn't at all like cotton picking, peanut picking, plowing, timber framing, roofing, or dog training. Tobacco work was careful work, slow moving, and downright boring. But somehow, he'd changed the way he felt about it. He'd come to love the easy rhythms. Maybe it was because he was getting older and tired. Maybe it was because he was slowing down. After 6 years of tobacco work, he'd grown used to the light pace of work. The best part of the job was the housing, if you could call it that. It was a crude cabin made of rotten clapboards, a dirt floor, a leaky tin roof, a fireplace made of mud and rock. There were dozens just like it, crooked structures with cockeyed gables and chickens roaming dirt yards. Eula and the girls slept inside. Paul, Vern, and Pete slept in a lean-to where the chickens often gathered and left little gifts on their pillows if they forgot to cover them with tarps. But morning brought simple blessings, coffee over a campfire, a sunrise, Paul's homemade biscuits from a sack of flour, and children. The children had gotten older since they'd first come to the Pettigrew farm. They were taller, leaner, and just when Paul thought they couldn't get any more beautiful, they proved him wrong. Eula's children had become the best part of Paul's life. So had Ruth. Eula kept to herself and could go full days without saying much. With each year, the children grew into miniature adults, and they acted like it, too. Ruth had found her favorite phrase, "I know." She said it all the time, and it made Paul smile every time the self-assured six-year-old reminded him that she knew something. Paul could practically write her future. She would grow into a confident girl who didn't need anything from anybody. And this made him proud of her, even as he hoped he'd live to see that version of her. But he might not. People died every day from little things. It was never the big things that got you. It was always the little things that swept you away from this planet. But it didn't concern him, for his purpose in life was clear. These children had become his purpose. And until he'd met them, he only wandered through life with Louisville and Vern. There was never a reason for doing anything. Now, he had more reason than he could stand. He heard Ruth's energetic footsteps on the porch. Ruth was often the first to wake in the mornings, though sometimes Reese would beat her to it. Most mornings, young Ruth would wander onto the porch half awake and sit on Paul's lap and watch the sun lift itself above the ground and wake up the world. And he would touch her shock of red hair, which was Paul's favorite thing in the world. Ruth galloped down the steps of the ugly house. She was all hair. Paul greeted her, but she was too sleepy to answer him. "What are you doing up so early?" he said. Ruth rubbed her eyes. She crawled into Paul's lap and rested her head against his chest. If there was a better feeling in the world, Paul didn't care to know what it was. She watched the world get brighter with him. The sun was becoming warmer every second. "Louisville was fussing in her sleep," said Ruth. "I can't sleep with all that noise. I wish she'd just sleep outside with you. No, she's old and deaf, baby. Her bones are sore. She can't help all that whimpering.
I know, but it's just so hard to sleep.
Oh, you be sweet to my old girl.
How old is Louisville?
Pushing 19.
That's old in dog years, right?
That's ancient.
Yeah, I know.
You sure know a lot.
Yeah.
In a dog's world, 19's a record.
Are you older than 19?
Not by much.
What would Louisville be like when she's your age?
Well, I expect Louisville be sitting next to the Lord by then. Lucky girl. Paul ran his fingers to her red curls. Her hair was thick and fell over her shoulders. She was the prettiest child he'd ever seen.
Are we really at war?
Said Ruth. Well, you and me ain't, but the rest of the world is. They watched the sun climb. He rubbed her head, more for his satisfaction than hers. This know-it-all girl was the most important thing he ever did with himself. Sometimes he looked at the stars at night and wondered if this was the reason he was created. For her. He said in a whisper, "It's almost time to eat, honey. You want me to show you how to stamp biscuits with an upside-down glass? It's sort of fun." But there was no answer. Her eyes were shut. She slept with her cheek against his chest. Their lives weren't beautiful. In fact, their lives were hard. And whenever they settled into a routine, along came something that changed that routine. They always seemed to be a few meals away from starvation, and they seemed to have less each month than they had the month before. But life doesn't have to be beautiful to be pretty, Paul thought. All it needs is red hair. I love you, sweetie, said Paul.
I know,
she whispered. Chapter 33, Girls into Ladies. Marigold admired her image in the mirror. She had never admired herself before, but she was admiring herself now, and it was a rare moment of happiness that she did not usually afford herself. But today she was in a good mood. There was something happy in her. Helen sat in bed reading a newspaper. She was sipping coffee from a tin mug and paying no attention to Marigold. Marigold smoothed her dress against her tummy. Somewhere along the way, she had outgrown her girlish frame and her childish clothes. She had become a tall, slender woman. It had all happened right before her eyes so that she never really noticed it. But today she did, and she was grateful for it. Most often, when Marigold looked into a mirror, she saw ugly. She saw a big-boned, copper-topped 15-year-old.
"You believe this?" Helen said. "They're calling up all the men." "What do you mean?" "The government. They're going to steal all our men, ages 18 to 41. It says right here in the paper." "Take the men? You mean they send them to war?" "Well, they sure ain't going to teach them to play patty cake."
Helen turned the page and shook her head.
"This war's going to put us out of business."
Earlier that week, Marigold had gone into town and stood in line at the post office. There she'd met an old lady in a blue dress with a matching hat. Most women avoided Marigold, but not this woman. They had talked. The woman was a pleasant woman who was better at conversation than most people. Before they'd parted ways, Marigold felt a familiar heat in her palms. It started in her palms and it moved upward to her elbows, then her shoulders. She was no longer afraid when this happened. She knew what it meant, and she knew what she had to do when her hands became hot. She did not ask the woman before she laid her hand on her neck. No sooner had Marigold touched her than she developed a headache that was so splitting it made her vision blur and her teeth hurt. The woman had only closed her eyes and started to cry. Marigold embraced her outside the post office. The woman told Marigold,
"Sometimes my migraines get so bad, I go 2 or 3 days without sleeping."
But Marigold already knew this before the woman had said it. She'd seen the woman's pain when she touched her.
"Are you a healer?"
"No," said Marigold.
"What are you?"
Marigold shrugged.
"I'm a redhead."
Marigold was interrupted from inspecting herself in the mirror by a horrible sound. Helen had dropped her newspaper and leaned over the edge of her bed. She wrenched forward. She moaned. A sound of splattering came next. Marigold ran to Helen, who was doubled over, vomiting on the floor. She hurled again and again until nothing more came up. She wiped her mouth with her forearm and caught her breath. Helen finally said, "I can't believe this." But she was interrupted by more heaving. Marigold touched her. She wanted to help Helen, but there was no heat in her hands, only her normal, clammy skin.
"Can't believe what?" said Marigold.
"I'm too old for this. This must be some kind of joke."
"What's a joke?"
"I thought I was all dried up inside. I thought I was all used up." Helen leaned over her bedpan. She missed. The floor was painted with bile. The smell made Marigold ill.
"This is my punishment," said Helen. "This is my judgment. This is judgment for what I am."
She heaved several more times until she was kneeling on the floor, leaning over the bedpan, crying. Marigold rubbed her hands together, willing them to become warm. She wanted nothing more than to rid Helen of nausea. She concentrated on her palms, but nothing happened. She tried patting them against her thighs. She closed her eyes. She even said a short prayer, but nothing happened. So she rested her hand on Helen's neck, which was covered in a thin film of sweat.
"What am I going to do with a baby?" said Helen.
The words made Marigold think of Maggie. She thought of the day she lost her. She remembered everything about that day. And in this moment, she became a dumb 15-year-old all over again. She felt as lost in this world as she'd ever been. And her hands became hot as fire. She touched Helen on the shoulder. She felt a current pass between them. It was like electricity, only gentler. The heat grew so hot, Marigold's hand became slippery, and when the heat dissipated, Helen stopped vomiting and wiped the corners of her mouth and turned to face Marigold.
"What did you do to me?"
Helen backed up against the wall.
"What in the devil did you do to me?"
"I don't think the devil had anything to do with it," said Marigold. Chapter 34. Laborers.
"Coots in love, coots in love," sang Aaron in a sing-song-like voice. "Coots in love, and he's got it bad, too."
"Yeah," said Billy. "He's in love all right. Look at him, the big dummy."
The night sky over the Oswalt sawmill was peppered with a million stars that seemed to get brighter with each passing minute. Teams of young men twirled their young ladies on the pine wood dance floor. Lanterns dangled above, and the candles adorned tables, but Coot thought these were poor substitutes for stars. The sounds of shoes on the dance floor were almost louder than the fiddle band that serenaded them. Clomping sounds of waltzing people filled the night with happiness and the kind of imagined adventures that youth offers. Coot was watching from a distance with the other mill workers near the barn. Coot was watching her. He always watched her. She was the loveliest thing on 2 feet. He could feel his face wearing a grin, even though she was so far away. Judy Bronson spun like a fairy out on the dance floor. Her blonde hair caught the light from the lanterns. It was illuminated and made her look like a heavenly being. Coot had never been in love before, not even close to it. But he believed he was in it now, with Judy Bronson. Of course, she hardly knew he existed, but this was only a minor technicality. Aaron snapped his fingers in front of Coot's eyes.
"Hey, Coot, are you even with us?"
"I think he's had too much moonshine," said Billy.
"No way, not the preacher. He don't never touch liquor."
"Yeah, he's a regular J. Wilbur Chaplin, ain't he?"
One boy slapped Coot's shoulder.
"Tell me, Mr. Chaplin, are you for or against the 18th Amendment? Inquiring minds want to know, Reverend."
The boys laughed so hard, Coot thought they were going to empty their bladders and their britches. But Coot didn't care. He was busy watching Judy. Judy knew how to dance, and Coot had never known this until tonight. She was nothing but graceful. No, poised was a better word for it. She was long and poised. Fair. That was also a good word for what she was. She was fair. She had white blonde hair and a charm that made even the grossest mill workers behave like Sunday school teachers when they were near her. Coot knew he didn't have a chance with her, but he was in love nonetheless. And you can't control who you love, even if it's bad for you. You can control what you know and what you think and what you do, but not who you love.
"Hey, preacher," said Aaron, "you're creeping me out with that face you wear."